Hello, everyone. My name is Tony Spezio, and this is Perspective. With me today is Spear Lancaster, who ran on the Libertarian Party ticket in 2002 for governor, and he is a former entrepreneur, has owned several businesses, and after retiring several years ago, decided to get involved in politics, and he is also the on the board of directors of a charter school here in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. And for those who don't know, Anne Arundel County is where our state capital, Annapolis, is located. Spear, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Okay. To begin, what were your thoughts on the election this past year?
Well, I believe that the election this year, 2010, was a continuum of 2008. And in 2008, the voters showed their disgust and lack of support of what I call the status quo, the people who were holding power at the time. And, of course, in 2008, it was the Republicans. And the voters very well let them know that they were unhappy and put the Democrats in with quite a margin. And, of course, the Democrats, naturally, assumed that this was a great moment for them and that the voters had really realized their real values and had gotten rid of those other guys. But the truth is, they really weren't voting so much for the Democrats as they were voting against the Republicans. But even further than that, they're voting against an entrenched system that's been in power at least since the late 1800s, which is a highly centralized, highly autocratic, form of government, centralized power, and a contempt, basically, for the voters. And this shows up in just innumerable ways, how the tax system is written and the laws are written. You've got a tax system that's 70,000 pages, give or take a few thousand, designed to reward the insiders and to punish the ordinary working man. And if people know this, they're starting to internalize this. And there are a lot of things going on that's causing this. And one of them is the dynamic shift where we're looking at the end of a 500-year period of the Gutenberg Press, which was supreme for 500 years, and was the methodology that changed medieval times and took us into the modern era. That is being quickly supplemented and in many cases supplants the newspapers. You talk to people under 30, and the majority of them do not follow a regular newspaper. Even their phones are no longer wired to a hardwired system. They're walking around with cell phones. And this is not happening just here. It's happening all over the world. So what you've got is a total change of climate. If I had a situation where the climate increased or decreased 20 degrees, all at once, if it was decreasing 20 degrees, I couldn't grow oranges in Florida. But if it increased 20 degrees, I'd probably be able to grow oranges in New Jersey. But since it doesn't change that much and is not too likely to change that much, in spite of all the fearmongers and people of that nature, we're not going to be seeing oranges grown too much further north than Florida. It's not even going to be grown in northern Florida. But the political scene and the cultural scene is a different animal altogether. One of the things that's phenomenal is that we're looking at the old established people or cultures in the world attempting to hold back this psychological and changes. I remembered when everybody in Southern Maryland, where I was born and raised, was still an advocate. Most of them were advocates, segregationists. And they prophesied that they would never see black people and white people eating together and so forth and so on. And they fought a very hard fight, but the times were against them. We have eliminated overt segregation. And frankly, when you go down there and talk to these people now, it's almost like they've got a memory gap. They don't any of them remember ever saying all this stuff. And it's just amazing how this has changed. And I see the same thing happening in government, in how we got, in governance. Our governance is going to be, the people are going to have more power. and the people are going to be more demanding. And I predict in 2012, you're going to see more of the same. The Tea Parties, in spite of everybody's hope that of the established quo, the entrenched ruling class, in spite of their hopes, the Tea Party is not going away. The Tea Party sprang up for different reasons, but the reasons are still there. And if anything, they're accelerating.
I have to agree with you there. You know, by the way, you know, you mentioned, you know, segregation, so I just wanted to go off on a little tangent. I can even notice from the time that I grew up in the late 70s and early 80s, as compared to today, there were things that were more frowned upon in those days that are that have become, while they haven't gone away, they've become a lot less true.
Yes.
Interracial dating, specifically of, say, a white man to a black woman, was much more rare in those days. Now it's become a lot more commonplace.
Yeah. You see that. Or you see, for example, in workplaces, not only interracial bosses,
right,
African Americans supervising other people, but you see females. Mm-hmm. So you and today it's not looked upon it with any as being unusual. In fact, it's almost totally acceptable. And you never hear anyone say, at least I haven't heard anyone say in years, oh gosh, I got a woman for a boss, so I've got a Hispanic boss. I mean, you know, bosses are bosses, and all over. And they all have to be dealt with. But
if I can go on a brief tangent about that, you know, about
sure.
Back when I was about 19, I worked at this shoe store in Laurel. And one of my bosses was a black lady, and she let me know in no uncertain terms how things were going to be run. And we had a little bit of a time trying to understand each other for the first month, but once we got to understand the other one, we learned to respect each other.
As they say, she explained it to you.
Yes, sir.
And that's what all good bosses do.
Exactly.
That's part of the boss's job, is to set the terms and policy and to see that they're enforced. And you've got two choices if you're an employee.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You can resign or you can get with the program.
Exactly. But anyway, back to the elections. Yeah, I remember in 2006, there were people that were so fed up with both what was going on at the federal level, and I'll concentrate here on Maryland, what was going on at the state level, that they decided to just vote everyone out. The only places where you saw a gain in the General Assembly in Maryland was in the northeastern district in Anne Arundel County, that's District 31, where that district went from two Democrats and two Republicans to all Republican. And just about everywhere else, there was Republican attrition in one way or another. I had never seen quite anything like it, at least since I've been observing in the early 90s. But things certainly did change, and
they've changed more superficially than in an absolute way. For example, it's still overwhelmingly impossible to take out someone like Nancy Pelosi or Steny Hoyer because of gerrymandering. And when you have a situation where in Maryland you have a very high percentage of African Americans, and whether you agree with them or not, they are almost 95% vote Democrat. And if you've got 31% of the people out of the gate lining up for the opposition, it's almost impossible to have any meaningful change. Now that is changing. And I could go on for lots of reasons, but that would take another couple of hours. But for example, one of the county council members, the only African American we have, who's a really great guy and I know him very well, he barely squawked by this time with 53% of the vote. Normally he would be 65 to 70% of the vote. And although the Republican Party in Maryland, like California, they bucked the trend as it were, what they did was they shaved the margin of an awful lot of Democrats who got reelected from 70% of the vote, 70-30, to like 60-40 or 35-55. And this is the type of thing you really want to keep your eye on. But the way the system is set up, it's there's really one party, and they have two branches, and they sort of like in business, General Motors has this particular share of the market, Chrysler has this share of the market, Pfizer makes these drugs, Merck makes another drug. But this is still not a real free choice, and we're heading to that, though. And it's, I don't think it's going to be take maybe 10 years, maybe even 20. We're definitely heading to that, and not just here. Not just here, all over the world. Europe right now is in a total turmoil because the people have finally realized that the EU has literally taken away their right to vote on anything. It's all done in Brussels by bureaucrats, and they're livid about it. And it's coming out in the open now, and I think you'll see this more and more.
By the way, you know, you mentioned the European Union. As something that I was chagrined by but not surprised by is that as part of the healthcare program that exists in many countries over there, they're talking about banning supplements. Hello, people. This is what socialized medicine is all about. And if we're not careful, it's going to come here. And it's going to bite us in the back end.
Whenever you give a decision to the government that needs personal input, you're going to get a bad result. I tell people, the greatest, smartest men in the world, if I got 10 of them here in America, the smartest people could not tell me when I'm hungry or when I need to go to sleep or where I'm hurting. This has to be an individual thing. And using government, to attempt to use government to fill in for the individual is a lot like getting oats after they've been through the horse. It's inefficient and they don't taste nearly as nice. You're so much better off to empower the people. And the founding fathers knew this. And the first line of the Constitution doesn't say we the king or we the pope or we the admiral. It says we the people. And they've done everything they can, especially in the past 100 years, to wrestle that power from the people, but delude them into believing that they have a vote. Now, this is a travesty because most of the time, in 85% of the cases, and half of all elections in America are run unopposed, which means that in half of all elections, the voters don't even have a choice because there's no one else there. Of the other half, a vast majority of them are so overwhelmingly skewed towards the incumbent that you still just might as well go down and watch the feed the ducks with the grandchildren.
Right.
So there really isn't a lot of people in play. And what has shook the two major parties up this year is the fact that they're starting to move in at the primary level, which is where the action is in many, many areas where it's a lopsided state. Like here in Maryland, you've got a much better chance of having an impact in an election at the primary level than you are once the person is elected. If I get elected, if I get on the ballot in Baltimore City as a Democrat, I'm good to go.
Yeah. Of course, you mentioned Maryland and Baltimore City. I mean, Montgomery County and Prince George's County. I mean, the primary election is not always the be-all and end-all, but it's become it.
It's the only chance you have to make an impact, period. Once I get on in Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Montgomery County or Prince George County, once I get on the ballot and I'm in the general, the voter registration is over 3-1.
Right. And when we come back, because we're going to go to a break very shortly, I'm going to want to talk a little bit about that because I think that the situation in Maryland is a lot different than a number of other states. So when we come back, we're going to discuss this further. And we are back with Spear Lancaster on Perspective. Spear, we were talking about Baltimore and specifically the Montgomery and Prince George's County areas, which, as we all know, cover the area, surround Washington, D.C., which is where most of the decisions take place. And those areas are predominantly dominated by Democrats in the state of Maryland. Thing is, my experience has been, seems like there's a machine that tends to control those areas. And if you don't fall within the traditional leftist agenda, you're pretty much shunned.
I think that's true, but I think what you're seeing is a fission in both major parties. Some of the biggest and most bitter fights are being fought now within the parties. In the Republican Party, you have the RINOs, which is a aphorism for Republican in name only.
Right.
And they're getting to be really defensive because people, especially from the Tea Party area, are coming out in masses and saying, this is, we don't want Democrat light. That's another pejorative term they use, Democrat light. And you hear them say, you know, if we're going to head towards the cliff, whether I'm doing 80 miles an hour or 65, I'm still going over the cliff, and I'm not happy with this. So this has been a major problem for the Republican Party. And you have you see these fights break out in the simple committees. The average person, well, matter of fact, out of 100 potential voters, a third of them don't even register. And out of the two-thirds that do, half of them don't vote. So two-thirds of them, for all practical purposes, are not even involved enough to go every 2 years or 4 years to vote, let alone get down to the point where they know who's on the central committee and why they're on the central committee and what's coming up. For example, right now in the Republican Party, there's a big fight over who's going to be the chairman of the GOP. For the state of Maryland. And you have a Tea Party type guy taking on the old team, and there are words being passed, and passions are pretty high. The same thing is happening with the Democrats in different places. For example, Pelosi, who had her agenda, and whether you like it or not, she was the Speaker of the House. It was her job to set the agenda. She did it. And an awful lot of what they call blue dog Democrats, which are typically Democrats like my family was in Charles County from rural areas, they're not that enamored with big government, and they don't think that the answer to all problems is government, and they don't want to politicize your toilet and how much water it goes out. They're having tremendous fights with these people who really want to tell you how much salt you can put on your French fries, like our New York mayor, or what kind of fats you can have in your cookies, and it gets a little bit ludicrous after a while. And because you just can't efficiently govern with that type of a program. So there's tremendous infights in both major parties, and what we're coming up with is a whole different paradigm. For example, of 1,000 voters, in the past, they broke pretty cleanly, Democrat and Republican. Now, the fastest growing segment in the voting block is non-affiliated. Now, if you take typical elections where you can win or lose by 5 or 10% of the vote, all I have to do is have 5 or 10% in the middle who is not happy with either major party and not loyal to any particular group. And this means that the people who are running for office are going to have to sit up and take notice. And it's going to be very painful for them. It's not going to be the old system, like you say, where the central committee gives the word as to what the program's going to be, and you do it. And you get your little reward, whatever that is. But that's going to be gone. And I think we're looking at another factor that's really going to impact the political parties, is that we've reached saturation point in government regulations and government taxing. We're well into about the 50% bracket here in the state of Maryland, easy. And if you're making six figures, when you get through your personal tax and your property tax and a licensing, it'll hit 50%. And I do this because I sit down with my estate planner every couple of years and talk about what can we do to eliminate, you know, and our tax burden. And I've been told that the minute I get any illness, I should move out of Maryland and do 6 months in Florida and a day, and make sure I do it, because the controller will be keeping track if he sees a meal that I bought on my credit card and I'm one day more in Maryland and I die. He's going to come in for an extra chunk of money. But this is becoming a lot easier to track, and the whole thing about transparency, When our current president ran, he made a big issue of transparency, but I think he's forgotten how to spell the word, let alone enforce it. And we're seeing the same thing happening with this Wikipedia. Wikipedia, all they're doing is putting out information that everyone really already knows. And, of course, the ruling class is very upset. This is like telling your old crabby relative or something at a family picnic that they are hard to get along with. You're supposed to, you know, tuck it in and say, oh, Aunt Jane, we always have fun when we're together, when in fact Aunt Jane is tough to work with.
I heard that. A couple of things. You talk about the leftist Republicans, the rhinos, Republican in name only, versus the more conservative elements. And I can remember in 1994, I had the opportunity to go to the Maryland State Convention in December, with a gentleman who has sadly passed on, and the backbiting that went on there was absolutely abhorrent. I mean, it's like this group doesn't like that group. I mean, just totally. I felt that. It's like, no wonder Alan Sauerbrei lost. It's like,
yeah.
But of course, yes, I will admit that there was fraud, but the Republicans were as much to blame, if not more so to blame, as the Democrats.
When people start talking about blame, I'm always reminded that President Kennedy said that success has 1,000 fathers and failure is an orphan. When it comes to blame, we can always point fingers. But generally speaking, it's not that simple. When you look at what happened in this past election here, take Maryland, where you would have thought that a lot more Republicans would have gotten elected, and you would have thought that a former Republican governor would have been better organized and gotten, but it didn't happen.
Right.
And who are you going to blame? Well, I've listened to everybody talk, but it's generally a combination of things. It's like you get out on the highway and it's a little bit sleeting and you're driving a little bit too fast and you are driving on tires that you should have replaced maybe a few months ago, and you're a little bit too close to the guy behind in front of you, and all at once something happens and you're bang, you're in the back end of the car in front of you. If you'd have dropped back a little bit, slowed down a little bit, maybe put new tires on. So we can't just pin it on one thing.
Yeah. A couple of things that I've noticed that I feel kill Ehrlich. Okay, number one, his lackadaisical performance in letting the conservative movement down. Okay. People elected him because they ignored the substance and looked at the rhetoric. But of course that happens every time. I mean, and like you said, if somebody's in power, then, they're going to, they want to get them out. But sometimes it doesn't matter who they are. They're not concerned about the substance. They look at the rhetoric. Another thing, I remember this past summer, taking a trip with the family to see, some family friends down in southern Colbert County. And I know that you could argue that, Colbert County has probably started to become a bedroom community for, Washington, D.C. Be that as it may, I saw O'Malley signs all over the place. Didn't matter where. I mean, this wasn't only on just routes 2 and 4. I mean, I saw them on the side roads. I'm like, I thought to myself, oh, it's in trouble.
if you look at Eric's campaign, where was he on the social issues?
Right.
He was not with the conservative constitutionalist section of the party.
Mm-hmm.
Where was he on taxes, or better than taxes, spending? When he was
right.
governor,
exactly.
He had one of the highest spending records the last year he was in of any governor at any time.
Right.
Where was he on immigration?
Mm-hmm.
Did he come out strong on immigration? I didn't hear him say anything about it in particular. Mm-hmm. How about health care? I didn't hear him talking a little bit about that. And last, how about Second Amendment issues? I mean, these are key issues that the conservative contingent wants to hear, and also a lot of the independents. And you didn't lose by 1 or 2%. He lost by a much wider margin than he did before. And to give you an idea, just the reverse happened with Andy Harris.
Right.
Andy Harris took and wised up. He realized what the voters had told him in 2008, made the corrections, went to the voters, told them he'd made the corrections, told them that he was going to do different, and they supported him.
By the way, you mentioned that election in the 1st Congressional District, and for those who don't know, in Maryland, the 1st Congressional District includes the entire Eastern Shore, portions of Harford and Baltimore County, and also portions of Anne Arundel County. I don't know if we here are sitting in the 1st Congressional District.
We are.
Okay. I know a number of Republicans were crying foul because we Libertarians ran Dr. Richard Davis in both 2008 and 2010. This year. And, you know, because the first time around, no one won with a majority, and Andy Harris came out on the short end of the stick that time, so to speak. And they were saying, oh, those votes that, Davis got could have gone to, Harris, and that's not the truth, not the case at all. And something else to keep in mind, and I don't think too many people realize this. There were fewer votes cast this time around than there were in 2008. Yet the only candidate to show an increase in votes was Dr. Davis.
Sure, did 20% more. Exactly. What's so phenomenal, as a Libertarian, I got a phone call from a very good conservative friend who told me I must be proud of myself because Dr. Davis had stolen the election from Andy Harris, and I laughed. I said, you know, that's a phenomenal thing that you're saying, and I really wish that the Libertarians were that strong. But let me remind you that John McCain, certainly not one of the most dynamic candidates that we've ever had, took every county on the Eastern Shore, and Andy Harris lost every county on the Eastern Shore, and he took them by a much, much wider margin than Andy Harris has lost. Andy Harris's loss went to hundreds. Dr. Davis took 8,000 votes in 2008, and he took over 10,000 votes this time.
Right.
But what was so phenomenal was I got three very, very expensive pieces of literature from the Democratic Party saying not to vote for Dr. Davis because he was against the health care program, and he was against increasing taxes, and he wanted smaller government. I mean, gosh, that's... What are we going to do with a person like this? This guy should be run out of town on the rail, let alone voted for. So the Democrats realized that Dr. Davis was taking more votes from them than he was Andy Harris. Andy Harris didn't run anything against Dr. Davis. Didn't have to.
And when we come back,
we'll be elaborating on this and a number of other different topics. And we are back here on Perspective, and I am Tony Spezio, and with me today is Spear Lancaster, former gubernatorial candidate for the state of Maryland on the Libertarian Party ticket, and we are talking about the past elections of the last few years, and predictions for the future. Spear, you know, you mentioned Harris versus Prattville, and you know, like I said, you know, we talked about how Andy Harris won, and he actually beat Frank Prattville by a good margin. And something that very few people know is that Frank Prattville received the endorsement from the NRA, endorsement from another.
Chamber of Commerce, I think.
Okay, Chamber of Commerce. Yeah, but I mean, he had received endorsements from non-conventional, at least what we would consider non-conventional endorsements from people that normally wouldn't endorse Democrats. And things definitely changed this time around. You know, closer to home, I'd like to concentrate a little bit on what happened in the General Assembly. And I had predicted that the Republicans would pick up between 4 and 12 seats in the House of Delegates, and I was right on that. They picked up 6. And I predicted that they would, that the net change in the Senate would be between -1 and +4. Now, as we all know, that was rather optimistic thinking on my behalf. I predicted the Lower Eastern Shore, Jim Mathias picking up the seat that Lowell Stoltzfus vacated. What I did not anticipate was Alex Mooney losing to former Mayor Ronald Young up there. Now, a couple of my predictions did turn out to happen. Patrick Hogan, who is former PG County Executive and Congressman Larry Hogan's son, won his seat up in Frederick. John Cluster won his seat up in
Baltimore County,
exactly. Sue Cullen in Northern Culver County, she lost her seat. She was a conservative Democrat. I'm sorry, right now the name of the person that got that seat kind of escapes me. But I know that Herb McMillan, who ran in 2002, got his seat back. And there was also a gain over in the Lower Eastern Shore, and I think that was about it.
Yeah.
And were you thinking that was going to happen, or what were your thoughts on that?
I had the Republican Party was really disorganized. And in my opinion, had a great difficulty getting any sense of direction and impact going. When Murphy ran against former governor Early, a lot of hard feelings ensued in that. And after it was over, and it depends on which side you talk to, they claimed that the other side didn't really get together and make up and get it going. In any event, there were an awful lot of Murphy voters that I talked to that did not seem to have any real interest in working too hard to get Governor Ehrlich elected, nor did they have a lot of interest to help the other Republicans. It was just that sort of thing where, like in a race, you stumble in the back part of the race, and while you get up and continue to run, you lose whatever chance you had of winning. So, and this happens in politics fairly frequently, but I think it really came to the front, and I think you said you were surprised that Alex Mooney lost, and I think there was probably no one any more surprised than Alex Mooney that he lost, because Alex had a record of being a very good fundraiser. He paid attention to the details, and you hear different people say why he lost, but the fact is, he got outgunned, and this is what makes it interesting.
Maybe it was a race that I didn't have my eye on, maybe because he had done so well in the past, or I don't know what it was, but when this happened, I'm like, oh boy. Interestingly enough, whether you know it, he sat on the Judicial Proceedings Committee in the Senate. And that is a committee that deals with a lot of issues with the Constitution and so forth. And at least as far as, I'll just take the right to keep and bear arms, he was probably, that was an 11-member committee for most of the time that I can remember. And he had, he had been the sixth vote. Or, you know, he was one of the 6 votes that stopped some of the horrendous legislation from getting through.
Right.
So I'm like, you know, what I'm thinking is, I wonder who is going to get that 11th seat. And,
well,
you know, well,
a lot of people are probably wondering who's going to get the 11th seat, but I'm going to tell you right now, it's not really very critical.
Okay.
And the reason it's not very critical, because you just had the Heller law in D.C., and then you had the McDonald law in Chicago, basically verifying that the Second Amendment right is an individual right, and it even goes back further than that, the right to life, is contingent upon being able to protect yourself. Don't tell me I have a right to life if you deny me the tools and the methods to protect myself. So the right to self-defense goes back from the time immemorial. And the idea that I should depend on a government who might be somewhere else, and I'm not going to make any negative remarks about what cops do in their off time, as a lot of people do, because I don't think they do this most of the time. I think most officers, just like most public officials, they are out to do a good job and do their best. But when you've only got 10 or 12 policemen on duty in an area that's got over 100,000 people, there's no way they can be everywhere. Now, you can argue all you want about, well, you might be better off not having the gun. Personally, being raised in a farm and having shot weapons from the time I was 6 or 7 years old, I enjoy having my firearms in my house. And maybe it's a false feeling, but I don't think government has a right to come in and tell me I can or can't own guns. And so I think this whole gun issue is going to go the way where eventually a lot of other issues went, because we're going to correct that.
Well, I hope you're right, but one thing that is I'm a little chagrined by, I can't think of the fellow's name, but there was a new appointee to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and he is, from what I understand, very hostile towards the right to keep and bear arms.
You're speaking nationally?
Yes, sir.
Well, of course. Obama has got a tremendous revolt on the left in the Democratic Party, and this, of course, is just one of the many issues. You see right now on this taxing people over $250,000, that's another issue. Mm-hmm. Staying in Iraq and Afghanistan is another issue. There's a real schism in the Democratic Party, from the Blue Dogs on the one side all the way over to the George Soros people who want world government. And, of course, world government, if you study the UN and sources, allies, they don't think you should have nail clippers, let alone guns.
Insane. Huh? But I guess it's... Yeah, you know, you talk about nationally how Maryland and California bucked the trend. I don't know if there were any other states that did.
Not to that extent.
Okay.
And the sad part about it, I say sad because I'm a resident of Maryland. If I was a resident of any other place, it wouldn't be sad at all.
Right.
But the sad part of it, if you look at our indebtedness compared to our per capita population or to our per capita income, California and Maryland are... and Rhode Island's another one, I mean, there's about a dozen of them, that are really, really in deep trouble when you look at the unfunded liabilities that we're facing, and they've got to be faced. We've got systems, and we refuse so far to actually deal with them, of defined benefit instead of defined contributions as far as your retirements are concerned. And we've got health care where... And you saw this play out in New Jersey with the teachers union, who wanted full health care without even putting up so much as a dime. This has got to stop.
Right. You know, one of the things that people have got to understand that there's not an unlimited ATM machine. And some things have got to be paid for sometimes, and you can't. You know, this bit about supplying benefits, you know, for unemployment or whatever, what we need to start encouraging people to do is to get employed.
Tony, there's an old saying, is if someone is educated beyond their capability, and we as a society and the Western world in general has become more and more secular, and we're too smart and too clever and too cunning to believe in things like religion and basic values, because we now have these smart people with all these PhDs telling you how you don't have to worry about that, how you can game the system. And it's sort of like the guy who's drinking a fifth of whiskey a day and eating a couple of Big Macs and double fries, and he's 55 and telling you, boastfully, how so far so good, he's not having any problems. But we all know, statistically speaking, the chances of him living to, say, my age without some major medical problems is slim to none. The same thing with government. There are And I hear people tell me all along, I've got a PhD in whatever, but I don't know anything about business or economics. And I feel like saying to them, sir, you are truly ignorant. And you cannot live in a world where the rules of economics are as absolute as the rules of physics. And if you think you can jump off of a 100-foot building without any bad consequences, you can keep breathing at it for the first 99 floors. But there's always that last floor, and the consequences are devastating.
To say the least.
Yeah, but we don't believe in Santa Claus anymore. We don't believe in, you know, things like that. But we believe in government. We've replaced one ideology with another ideology. Mm-hmm. And I see people posing as Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, talking what frankly, and I hate to say this, but it's gibberish. Because when you pin them down and say, well, where's the money coming from? How is it going to be right to take money from working people to give wealthy people tax breaks? Or to give people who have had no responsibility for their well-being and now are like 40 years old and they've got serious illnesses and they want unlimited health care for as long as they live. But mm-hmm. who's going to pay for it?
Exactly.
The working stiff with a couple of children, one of them who needs orthodontal work, but he can't afford it because the taxes are so high, he's got to support this other fellow. It borders on being not only foolish, but frankly immoral. If I can't take a gun and go over and commandeer my neighbor's car, why can the government commandeer something from him? I don't understand it.
Well, I guess people have gotten addicted to the idea of someone is going to take care of them.
And well, yeah, but people get addicted on other things too. But an addict is an addict is an addict.
You hit the nail.
And when people are addicted, they are not. They're dysfunctional. They're not rational. They're not responsible. And they shouldn't expect me to look up to them or even feel kindly towards them.
Right.
About all I can do is have compassion. They are human beings. They are, like the rest of us, that they're false. But I cannot deny and overlook the fact that they are addicts. And an addict is someone who's out of control.
And you hit the nail right on the head. And that's about all the time that we have for today. This has been Perspective. My name is Tony Spezio. And all correspondence can be addressed to perspective01@hotmail.com.